okay.
Got to get a good recording for John. But we've been looking at things about Jesus. We're looking at the miracles of Jesus. I think you're going to hear some things today that may be surprising that when people have looked at miracles. John wanted us to first look at the concept of a miracle. Like, what is a miracle? Does anybody have any thoughts of how would you...
I think it's something that you cannot explain in human terms.
Something you can't explain in human terms, yeah. Anybody else have a kind of garden variety definition? Dan?
Usually requires supernatural forces.
Something that requires supernatural forces, not just the everyday, you know, things that we see. And John, if you're following along with these classes or if you're following along online, you know, John's posting the audio and the PowerPoint, the notes, you know, from each week. There's things that we kind of throw the word miracle around a lot. John has on the PowerPoint, was it a miracle when Reggie Miller scored 9 points in the last 11 seconds of a game? Now, I'm from Indiana, so that really, you know, it fires me up that the Indiana Pacers would have that happen. If you remember, a few years ago, there was a movie called Miracle about the American Olympic hockey team, you know, having this big upset. You know, they're the underdogs. They defeat the Soviet hockey team, and they dramatize that in a movie called Miracle because we beat those godless communists, and somebody up there must like us. Yeah, must be a miracle. So the word's thrown around very casually to mean something unlikely or, you know, a big comeback story or just something unexpected. And sometimes we look at people's lives. I mean, somebody becomes a disciple of Jesus. Their life totally transforms. They get away from the drugs or they get away from the immoral relationships. Their language changes and it's like a new person. And it's easy to see that's the transforming power of God, and it's hard not to see that as miraculous. As important as that is, you know, we've all got testimonies of how we became a Christian and how God changed our lives, and that's a big part of being a new Christian. It's a big part of being an old Christian as we look back at, you know, how God originally saved us and changed us. But hopefully as older Christians, we still have a testimony of God answering prayers and God working in our lives. And miracle gets thrown around a little bit. And there's some more precise definitions, probably what most people think about, what some people shared. C.S. Lewis, and you can't really do an apologetics talk without mentioning C.S. Lewis. You know, he's kind of the king, so you have to quote him somewhere. C.S. Lewis, he wrote a book called Miracles, and he said, quote, "I use the word miracle to mean an interference with nature by a supernatural power," end quote. Webster's Dictionary gives the English word miracle. "A miracle is an event or effect which apparently contradicts known scientific laws." So this is what kind of a few of us said in here. This is kind of the garden variety definition, and you can have more nuanced definitions of it, but that's kind of the rough and ready understanding we kind of come to it with. And do we have a PowerPoint? Okay, let's see.
See how we do here.
Dan. Yeah, I'm Dan Condor. I work with John and Jan. We get to do some of these kind of events. But,
just so you know, Dan is on our board of directors for Apologetics Research Society.
Oh.
And he is also helping us put on a conference in New York, Nebraska this summer.
Cool.
And teaching, and he'll be helping us out a lot. Dan Condor.
Woo!
Thanks.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to get my keep-to-keep.
Yeah, that would be awesome. You're probably more
computer savvy. But the English word miracle is derived from a Latin word. Was the Bible written in Latin? It's written in some Greek, some Hebrew, some smattering of Aramaic. And so our English word miracle is derived from a Latin word. And so we translate the Bible into English. We kind of slap this Webster's definition onto it. And the Bible is a little more nuanced. There's different words that are being used. One is dunamis, which it means a power or ability, physical or moral, residing in a person or thing. And so sometimes this word, Greek word dunamis, is translated as miracle. Sometimes in the Bible it'll talk about wonders, you know, somebody that works a wonder. The Greek word is teros, meaning something strange, a marvel. John notes here, a wonder appeals to the imagination. You know, something that just captures your imagination. It's a wonder. It makes you marvel. And then we have a Greek word, semion, meaning a sign or signal. And John points out, John Oakes points out that this is probably what we're thinking of in apologetics terms, because a miracle isn't just this weird, bizarre, paranormal, extraordinary, Ripley's Believe It or Not type thing. It's not just a random thing. It's pointing to something beyond itself. You know, a miracle has a message to it. And so this word semion, and from which we get the word semiotics and some other terms, but it means a sign or a signal. And the Gospel of John, if you notice how the Gospel of John is structured, it's structured around seven miracles. And then at the end of the Gospel, John concedes, he's like, hey, there are many other things that Jesus said and did, more, you know, the world doesn't have room for all the books that could be written about Jesus. So he admits he's been a little selective at what he's chosen to talk about. And but he's always talking about these signs, you know, that the turning of water into wine is a sign. It's not just, you know, Jesus performing this miracle and helping out the wedding, you know, which is obviously kind of in the immediate context what he's doing, but it's pointing to something beyond itself. It's a sign. It's saying something about God, about who Jesus is. And so a miracle is kind of a supernatural testimony of a sort. And so that shouldn't be lost. And we can throw the word miracle around of, you know, my team won in the last few seconds of the game. Or, you know, there was this horrendous car crash and this little newborn baby survived. Just all the wonderful things. But that's maybe a little looser than we should be with the word miracle. And miracle is pointing to something beyond itself. And we live in a very skeptical age. People are very skeptical about God and religion and miracles oftentimes. And so that's a real question. Are miracles possible? Now, if God exists, then miracles are possible. If it's even possible that God exists, then miracles are possible. And so we have to be open to those possibilities. Now, not everything that we call a miracle is a miracle. Not everything that's, you know, God could do, he doesn't do everything that we wish that he would do or want him to do. But there has to be that possibility granted. And there's a lot of very skeptical, secular humanist thought today in the media and education. And people kind of scoffed at the idea of miracles. Actually, it's very hard to say miracles are impossible. There was a debate many years ago. Dr. Gary Habermas debated one of the world's most famous atheists, Professor Anthony Flew, who was an atheist, very outspoken, a very prominent philosophical atheist, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century. So Dr. Habermas debated Anthony Flew on the resurrection of Jesus. And Habermas presented evidence and arguments and a historical case for the resurrection of Jesus. And John will touch on that next week. But so Habermas presented this whole case, and Anthony Flew replied to it. And this debate, the way it was set up, it was judged by a panel of judges. And so both participants had agreed, you know, we agreed to a panel of judges. We'll decide who won the debate. And we accept these guys that you've chosen as judges. So they had a disinterested panel of judges to decide who won the debate. They said Anthony Flew lost the debate. The atheist lost. Why? They said, well, this is a formal public debate. You present arguments and evidence, and then you address the arguments and evidence of your opponent. And Anthony Flew basically was like, well, miracles are impossible. You're saying Jesus is raised from the dead. That's impossible. That couldn't have happened. I don't care how much evidence you give. It just couldn't happen. And the panel of judges said, well, that's not good enough for a debate. You can't just presume atheism, Professor Flew. You just can't assert that these things can't happen. You can't assume that there's no supernatural. You have to present a case. And you figure this panel of judges probably, you know, trying to be objective and impartial, but they were like, you didn't make your case, Professor Flew. You just asserted your worldview. You have to prove what you're trying to assert. And it's actually very hard to just discount out of hand the possibility of the miraculous, including miraculous technological feats. Pedro Figueroa, a miracle worker. In a loose sense, but I'll take it. I'll take it. Okay. You guys can see this? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Now I was just reading this in my quiet time yesterday. It was interesting. This is a story. If you remember, there's a time in the Old Testament the Philistines capture the Ark of the Covenant. God allows this to happen because of the unrighteousness of the Israelites, of Eli and, you know, his sons. And so Philistines capture the Ark of the Covenant, which is a holy thing to the Lord, and they take it to their pagan temple of Dagon. You know, it's right at the foot of this statue, this idol of this pagan god. Then the next morning they come in, the idol of Dagon has fallen. Thank you. The idol of Dagon has fallen. It's bowing down before the Ark. And they're like, oh, this isn't good. So they prop up the idol again. The next day, the idol of Dagon has fallen down as though it's bowing to the Ark, and his head and hands are broken off the idol. And a plague breaks out among the Philistines. And they say, well, we heard the stories of how God delivered Israel from Egypt and how God's mighty hand was on the Egyptians, punishing them, judging them. And now we think God's hand is on us. What should we do? They ask their scholars, their wise men. And here in 1 Samuel 6, verses 8 and 9, it says, here's what the wise men of the Philistines advised them to do. They said, take the ark of the Lord and put it on a cart, and in it a chest beside it. Put the gold objects you are sending back to him as a guilt offering. Send it on its way, but keep watching it. If it goes up to its own territory toward Beth Shemesh, then the Lord has brought this great disaster on us. But if it does not, then we will know that it was not his hand that struck us, but that it happened to us by chance. So even in the ancient world, there was this understanding that not everything was a miracle. Not everything is a supernatural occurrence. And in our modern view, there's that skepticism, that secular humanism, to look back and, well, in ancient times, people believed in miracles. They were primitive people. They were very superstitious. They believed anything, all kinds of crazy mythological ideas. But you can see this is a fairly common sense reply that these pagan Philistines give. They like, They're like, well, we think the hand of God is upon us. We've got the Ark of the Covenant, and now it looks like we're being punished. But maybe it's just a run of bad luck. Maybe this, you know, just randomly happened. But it looks like it's a curse from God. So let's return the Ark of the Covenant to Israel. And if you see this happen, then it'll prove, okay, we were under God's curse. If this other thing happens, well, you know, it's just a natural event. Maybe we need to look at some other cause and effect things that have happened. So they weren't quite as superstitious as we would maybe think that they were. Definitions of miracle from C.S. Lewis, from Webster, and from someone named Oakes. An event which requires the intervention of God. Here's Reverend Samuel Clark. He was an Anglican clergyman, British philosopher. And around 1710, he wrote, the true definition of a miracle, in the theological sense of the word, is this, that it is a work effected in a manner unusual or different from the common and regular method of providence by the interpretation either of God himself, by the interposition of either God himself or of some intelligent agent superior to man for the proof or evidence of some particular doctrine or in attestation of the authority of some particular person. So here Samuel Clark is pointing to this fuller sense of it's a sign. The miracle is pointing to something beyond itself. It has a message about the authority of someone, about the credibility of someone, about the credibility of a doctrine. And so your more nuanced definitions are going to bring this out. And this I mentioned, Acts 2.22, Peter preaches at Pentecost that Jesus was a man accredited to you by God by miracles, wonders, and signs. And miracle, we have the word dunamis, wonder, teros, and sign, the word semion. I'm not sure if it's working. But I thought this was it. Yeah, it might be a different one. Yeah, go ahead.
Does that appear more times than the other ones?
I don't really know the number of times it's in there, but like the Gospel of John, when it talks about signs, this is the Greek word. So usually they're going to translate Simeon as signs in an English translation, but I don't know which really appears more. But that's a good question. Okay. Did everybody get this slide here? Or? Okay. Cool. Thank you. Some assembly required. Cool. Thank you. This is the DIY. No, it's not.
Press the arrow.
Yeah, we need intervention.
Yeah, divine intervention.
If you point it to the screen, you should be able to.
Yeah? It's not doing it. Okay, this is a little review. Do miracles happen? We're all wondering that now more than ever. But John, of course, being a physicist and chemist, he wants to know what can science tell us. Sometimes people will make broad claims of, science disproves miracles. Or, well, we've got science that discounts the supernatural. It's not quite Not quite that simple. You can use science to maybe debunk a particular thing. There was a famous case many years ago. There was a televangelist, so you can already see where this story is going. There was this televangelist named Peter Popov that, you know, he would be giving these great revival meetings, and he would be saying things about people in the audience. He would get these revelatory words of knowledge from God supernaturally. And he'd say, is someone named Diana here? Diana, do you live at 2222 Baker Street? Yeah, and it was just wowing people. And then somebody got a little curious about it, and they got kind of a scanner, you know, like a CB radio, like a police scanner type thing. And they start scanning radio frequencies, and they pick up Peter Popov's wife's voice saying to him, feeding him all this information. He's got a little earpiece, and he's walking around. They've gotten information on people there that are coming into the meeting, and, you know, just as they've met them at the door. And so now he's getting all these. And so science can debunk, you know, certain alleged miracles. But to say science discounts all miracles, science can kind of help us, you know, clarify some things. But you can't throw miracles out. But if you want a good, Steve Martin did a movie, I don't know if you remember, Leap of Faith.
Yeah.
And he was playing the part of this Peter Popov type televangelist that's, you know, scamming everybody. And and you can imagine Steve Martin would have a lot of fun, you know, in that role. But here in 2 Kings, we have a curious story in the Old Testament. You may remember this. 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 4 through 6. Someone is out chopping wood, and Elisha the prophet is nearby. The axe head flies off the axe into a pool of water. And the man is like, not only has he lost this axe head, this iron axe head, but it was borrowed. So it's even worse. Then it says, the man of God asked, where did it fall? When he showed him the place, Elisha cut a stick and threw it there and made the iron float. So the axe head floats to this. You guys remember this story? It's a very curious story in the Old Testament. And frequently skeptics will latch on to a little story like this. They'll pluck some little incident out of the Bible and say, do you really believe this silly Sunday school story of, you know, axe head floating out of the water? We know, you know, iron is going to sink in water. It's not going to float like wood. The law of gravity, and just this couldn't happen. So they'll latch on to something like this and, you know, point, do you believe this? Do you really believe this? Come on, we know that's impossible. But we have to look at it in context of the whole biblical worldview of the whole Bible. Does anybody know the first verse of the Bible? Just in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth out of nothing. All physical matter in all its states and all its forms, all physical energy in all its forms and states, all physical space in all its dimensions, all physical time was created when the beginning began. God created it out of nothing. That pretty much sets the stage for everything that happens after that. You know, that's the original miracle. And, you know, if God can do that, you know, what else? What, you know, that, once that kind of sets the stage, it all begins. God created the heavens and the earth. God is the unmade maker of heaven and earth. Everything that has been made, he made. Now, this is something, I got something like this. I don't know if you ever had anything like this when you were a kid. You know, mom and dad buy the set, and it gives you a checkerboard, a backgammon board, dominoes, and then you can play all these games. And my sister and I had one when we were kids that had all the games in it. And we liked here at, we liked these, the dominoes. Yeah. Now, you can play dominoes. You got the guys out there at the family picnic, at the picnic table, you know, doing the... And I'm sure that's a game of some kind, but we had no interest in that game. What we wanted to do was set up those dominoes and do like they did on TV and have all these designs and have it, you know, knock things down and do... And so we would set up the dominoes. Now, picture this. If I'm... playing with dominoes and setting up the dominoes in a row and just knocking them down, and then I stack up, you know, a stack of books over here and another stack over here, and I lay the chessboard across the two books, and then I stack the dominoes on the chessboard in a straight line, and then I go between the books and I lift up the board with my left hand, carefully balancing. This takes a lot of imagination that I would have this kind of coordination. I know. But it's not a miracle, but just... So I'm holding up the chessboard. I've got my line of dominoes, and then I can just tap with my right hand this domino. Click, 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 goes all the way down, and the last domino falls off the board. And that would, you know, that would be pretty cool. So then I set it up, I do it again, and then... That gets a little old, and so I am holding it with my left hand, and I've got the dominoes all lined up on the chessboard, and then I hit it with my right hand, click, 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 and the last domino falls off the edge of the board, and I catch it with my right hand, and I'm like, this is pretty neat. And but if that line of dominoes, here's the mind bender. If that line of dominoes went on forever, if it just extended out this way, could we ever have a domino fall off this other side? Well, I couldn't reach it, for one thing. I could never get to that last domino. But even if I had an infinite reach, there's no first domino. There's no starting point, so you could never have a domino fall off. Now think, in this illustration, if each domino was a day. And so, you know, I click the days and it goes Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and it comes down to today. You know, the last domino, Saturday, falls off. But if we had an infinite number of days in the past, could we ever get to today? This day leads to this day leads to this day leads to today. If we had an infinite number of days, so the days had to start somewhere. We know time began at some finite point in the past. So horizontally, we know there had to be a beginning. And philosophers developed this argument. It's called the Kalam cosmological argument for the existence of God. And Dr. William Lane Craig, one of the prominent Christian philosophers and apologists today, has developed this argument, uses it in debates. So we just know by human reason. You know, it didn't take any science or really anything. It's just, you know, concepts of what infinity would mean. And so we know by reason that it had to have a beginning. Just like the Bible says that when the beginning began, God created the heavens and the earth. But you had a...
Yeah, so God is existent, right?
Like right.
He existed in itself. So you believe, like, he was always there. But we are counting from when he decided to make earth or to make the world, you know?
Yeah, when the universe began, that's kind of when
right.
physical time began.
Do you think that we could ever...
And when is when?
Right.
How do we... Yeah.
It has to come down to our faith. Like, either you believe that he did or...
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's
yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Is there an argument that's just like, well, how do we know that there's an end of time? You're saying that there... To have an end, there has to be a beginning. But we haven't hit an end.
No.
So, I mean, so is there an argument out there that's like, well, is there an end? You know, or is it just infinite always? That there was never a beginning, there's never an end.
Yeah, that gets into theories of time, whether there are time is where the physical time began at what we would think of as the Big Bang, or yeah, the Big Bang theory before it was even a show. But
oh, yeah.
but Or is time a metaphysical property that's part of God, and there was some kind of prime time before, you know, time began at the Big Bang? So that gets into theories of time, and so there's speculation about that, of just how it all rolls out. But go ahead.
I'm just going to say that most scientists believe that in the Big Bang.
Right.
And the reason they believe in the Big Bang is because they know that if we say the universe has always been here, then we would say that at some point energy, the scientists believe that there's going to be a time where energy is going to run out.
Yeah.
And if the universe is infinite, then the energy would have run out already.
Uh-huh. That's true, too.
So
yeah.
Most scientists will say there was a beginning point, and then, of course, the question comes, well, what started the beginning?
Yeah.
And so most, John will tell you that most scientists believe that the universe was created out of nothing. Mm-hmm. So the concept of the Big Bang in itself is a miracle.
Right.
Right.
So if you go from that premise that the Big Bang started from nothing, then you accept that the universe was started miraculously.
Yeah. Yeah, so that, I'm just talking about human reason. We think about infinity and what it would take. There had to be a beginning somewhere. Then we add on science, you know, this thermodynamics of you have to start out with energy and it kind of runs down. It couldn't have been here forever or we would have already run down. And that gets into, that goes into scientific ideas of what they call physical eschatology, that the universe is going to run down. Eventually all the energy is going to spread out and degrade. But that gets into science, so the science also fits with, yes, there was a definite beginning.
How do you feel about the Big Bang theory?
I'm personally very comfortable with it because it says there was a beginning.
Yeah.
So it fits. Yeah. It would be a blast of light going out in all directions.
So
yeah. Yeah, so it's very interesting. But here's another aspect to our dominoes. Before we had all this scientific knowledge about thermodynamics and the Big Bang model for the creation of the universe, before they'd even thought about this, Kalam cosmological argument, what happens if I'm doing this nutty experiment with these dominoes and I'm catching it with my hand and doing all that and Mom walks in? Ah! A little embarrassing. So my left hand drops. What happens?
There's no... It stops right there.
How many of the dominoes fall?
How?
All of them. Roughly at the same time. Because they're being supported by my hand. And so thinkers around the world have thought of this. This is certain Indian philosophers thought of this. Certain Neoplatonic philosophers thought of this. Aristotle thought about this. And then later you have followers of Aristotle, like Thomas Aquinas in the Roman Catholic tradition. And then you have Moses Maimonides and the Jewish, these medieval philosophers. He's a Jewish philosopher. And then you had Avicenna, which is a Muslim philosopher. They're all kind of following Aristotelian thought. But they're like, we have this whole series of causes and effects, you know, like the dominoes. You know, this domino hits this one, hits this one, hits this one. We got a whole series of causes and effects. This is part of our common sense, common experience of the world, that there are causes and effects. But what is holding that whole system of causes and effects together? What is keeping everything in existence from moment to moment? And they're like, there has to be an uncaused first cause that is supporting the whole causal system. And by first cause, they don't mean the first in the series. That would be horizontally this Kalam cosmological argument. They're talking first as in foundational. Like, there has to be a primary cause that is uncaused, that's outside the causal system, that's supporting the causal system. So if God was not keeping the universe in being, it would be gone. You know, there would be no existence. There would be no universe. And you may not buy all the Aristotelian philosophy and all the, you know, all the metaphysics involved with that, but the Bible actually teaches this. One place, Colossians 1, 15 through 17, in him all things hold together. That God supports the world, he sustains it by his word. That Jesus, you know, the creator, is holding things together, is supporting things. And so maybe you don't buy all the philosophy and all the ins and outs of that, but the Bible is teaching in some form or fashion the world exists not just because, you know, God the Heavenly Father, Jesus the Eternal Son, you know, God the Holy Spirit created it, but it's existing right now because of God. So is this really an issue?
No.
Not really.
Is a floating axe head, is that, you know, like, I mean, God created all of it.
Yeah.
That axe head is sustained in existence. You know, God designed all these laws of nature, these natural forces. You know, God maintains those laws of nature. So is it, you know, a floating axe head, is that really a... is that really an impossibility? Is any of these Old Testament miracles, is any of these too hard for God? You know, the flood? Even, you know, a global flood. You know, some people, you know, Christian circles believe in a global flood. You know, the waters were higher than Mount Everest. And some people believe in a more regional flood. Whatever the nature and extent of the flood, I mean, we have to use our best judgment, go into Scripture, look at the science and kind of, you know, weigh it out, figure out the nature and extent of it. But would any flood be too much for the God that created the universe, that sustains it? People throw out, well, you know, how could you put every species of animal into the ark? The word species isn't in the Bible, so that's not really, you know, what the Christian worldview is talking about. But... you know, is any of these miracles, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, would that be unlikely or just out of God's reach?
No.
The plagues of Egypt, you know, the pillar of cloud and flame in the desert, the parting of the Red Sea, the manna and the quail and the water that he brought to the Israelites, thunder, lightning, and flame, trumpet blasts on Mount Sinai there in Exodus, judgment on those in Korah's rebellion, the budding of Aaron's staff, like where, you know, Korah that led the rebellion against Moses, he gets swallowed up. That's a pretty wild story, but would that be impossible for a God that created and sustains the universe to do? So you go through all these things, and they're incredible stories, and we can kind of puzzle out what was the nature and extent of some of these. The sun stands still and hailstones at Gibeah in Joshua. Now, could God do that?
Yes.
If he creates and sustains the universe? Now, some people will argue, well, for the sun to stand still in the sky, God would have to stop the rotation of the earth. If the earth stopped rotating, it would disintegrate. Just physically, the whole earth would disintegrate. But I think the God that creates and sustains the universe, if he's capable of stopping the earth, I think he could probably keep it together, you know, for a little while. Now, that's now is that exactly how it happened? It might have been just the, I mean, basically Joshua wants some more daylight so they can finish the battle against the enemies, and God gives him more daylight. And Dr. U. Ross, a Christian apologist, had proposed, well, there's some atmospheric things going on. There's the hailstones. There's kind of some weird things going on. So it might have appeared to Joshua from his vantage point that, you know, the daylight was preserved. I mean, obviously, Joshua doesn't have a watch where he can tell, you know, wow, it lasted a whole other day. So, but he's got more daylight. And how God did that, we don't know. We can, you know, kind of speculate on the mechanics of it. But this isn't really beyond God to do. But we had better take a break. I can tell you need more muffins. And we're a little behind schedule, but we'll make it up. We'll work really hard. But, thank you. Let's pull it in. We've got a short time left, so I want to launch on to our main topic, Jesus and miracles. And I think this will be some material that maybe you weren't aware of about Jesus and his miracles. John points out, we're having to skip ahead a little bit for the sake of time. I want you guys to get out on time. But John points out here, as far as Jesus and miracles, he sees four possibilities. One, that Jesus neither worked miracles nor claimed to work miracles. Now, that seems a little unlikely when the information we have has Jesus working miracles and acknowledging it openly. The second possibility, Jesus claimed to work miracles, but he was a charlatan. He was just a phony. He was a fake. He was like Peter Popov or one of these fake televangelists, faith healer guys. Another possibility is Jesus worked genuine miracles. But he was a sorcerer. He's doing this by the power of Satan or demons or, you know, he's not doing this by God. These are counterfeit miracles. He's a false prophet. He's doing false signs and wonders. What the Bible sometimes calls lying signs and wonders, things that deceive people and take people astray. Or Jesus worked genuine miracles, and his claims about himself are validated by those miracles. And you think back of Samuel Clark and C.S. Lewis and John and some of these definitions of miracle. It's a supernatural act, but a miracle has a message. It is a sign. It is a signal. It is trying to lend credibility to a message or to the messenger. And so that's the final possibility, is this is a God's seal of approval on the ministry and message of Jesus. We'll have to look at those possibilities here. The Jews expected the Messiah to give miraculous signs. There are many passages in the Old Testament, the prophetic passages, that the age of the Messiah would be an age of miracles, be an age of wonders. And there's a number of passages in the book of Isaiah, and particularly Isaiah 35. It mentions a lot about miracles of healing that the Messiah would do. And this is an interesting thing in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So this isn't a biblical passage. This is just a Jewish writing. And these were the Dead Sea Scrolls were composed. It's maybe 2nd or 1st century B.C. into the 1st century A.D. So just maybe a little past the time of Jesus. So the Dead Sea Scrolls contain copies, our oldest copies, for the most part, of the Old Testament. They have a lot of commentaries on the Old Testament, and they have other Jewish writings. And so it gives us this picture of what some of the Jewish beliefs were at the time of Jesus. What was some of the cultural background going on? And this particular one is called the Messiah Apocalypse. And I don't know where John got this picture, if this is the actual part of it, but the real Messiah Apocalypse, this 4 Qumran 5, verses 21. It is very shredded. It's fragmentary. There are parts of it that are hard to read, hard to translate. I think I've cleaned it up here a little bit. If you look, and I'm going to highlight these yellow portions, I've cleaned it up a little because there's words and letters that kind of drop out of it when they try to translate it. It says, "For he will honor the pious on the throne of eternal kingship by setting prisoners free, giving sight to the blind, straightening out the bent. And glorious things that did not exist the Lord will do, as he has said, for he will heal the badly wounded, and the dead he will make alive. To the poor he will bring a good tiding, the uprooted he will lead, the hungry he will enrich." Now this is not scripture. This is just a Jewish writing, but it gives you an idea the climate of the first century when Jesus was around. There was this expectation that Messiah would bring miracles, particularly miracles of healing, but other miracles as well. And that's a whole topic in and of itself. And John offers some reasons to believe that Jesus worked miracles. A great number of the miracles were done publicly, often in front of the greatest skeptics and harshest critics of Jesus. So this was in large groups of people among friends and enemies. And it was a high-context society, you know, with very tight-knit families. And so it wasn't like today, some faith healer, you know, has his big arena meeting and somebody comes up to the stage and he throws his coat at him and knocks him down and, oh, my back, it's healed. Yeah. Well, that's pretty easy to have a plant in the crowd that'll come up and fake something like that. You couldn't really do this in Israel when you have your uncle in the village that has always, you know, been blind. And then he goes to Jesus. Jesus heals him, and now he can see. I mean, everybody knows if that's true or false. I mean, that would run through a family, that would run through a village, and Jesus built this huge reputation. You know, people are coming to him to be healed, to have demons cast out. He had this reputation because of this relational context of that world. So it was much more difficult to fake something as opposed to today, where you can have a random guy show up on stage and, you know, claim something. But there were tens of thousands of eyewitnesses from every background to these events. The apostles openly proclaimed that Jesus worked a great variety of miracles during the lifetime of those who could have refuted those claims. So the disciples are preaching this. Eventually it gets written down. You know, all the New Testament documents are written in the first century within the lifetime of eyewitnesses to those events. And so sometimes people try to say, well, the New Testament, the Gospels, the stories of Jesus, this was just oral tradition. This was just like telephone game. One guy tells one guy, tells one guy, and it all gets distorted. Well, once again, this is a high-context society. It's never a linear one guy tells one guy tells one guy. This is happening, you know, multiple eyewitnesses, and people talk about it, and things spread, and Jesus has his hand-picked apostles that preserve, you know, his teachings and what happened, and they're kind of the authorities on his life. So you have this oral tradition, but oral tradition within the lifetime of eyewitnesses that can challenge or correct that tradition is considered oral history. It's not just oral tradition of, oh, this has been passed on, you know, telephone game for centuries. No, this was within the lifetime of eyewitnesses, you had all the oral tradition. It's written down within the lifetime of these eyewitnesses, and we have it today that we can look at. It's all been preserved. And so we don't have just legends about Jesus, although there are some that spring up, you know, later on. But God has preserved in Scripture these accounts from eyewitnesses and Jesus' handpicked apostles. Both Roman and Jewish histories report at least the general fact that Jesus worked wonders. And we'll look at some of those. And if you've been coming the last few weeks or following along online with the notes or the audio or the PowerPoint, you do have Josephus and different people that record, people outside the New Testament, people that are not Christians, often people that are hostile to Christianity. So it's outside the Jesus tradition. It's outside the 27 books of the New Testament. Then you have all the early Christian writings that talk about Jesus working miracles. You know, you have all the heretics, all the Gnostics. They acknowledge that Jesus worked miracles. The Roman Catholic tradition, the Greek Orthodox tradition. All the Christians basically agree. You know, Jesus worked miracles. All the people that had different splinter groups of Christianity. But you've got non-Christians and even some hostile anti-Christian writers that do concede that, yes, he was a miracle worker. And we'll get into that in a second here. Pharisees and rabbis did not deny the miracles, but instead claimed Jesus did the signs by the power of demons. If you remember John 8, verse 48, it says, "The Jews answered and said to him, 'Do we not rightly say that you are a Samaritan and have a demon?' Jesus answered, 'I do not have a demon, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me.'" So they're saying, you're a Samaritan, you're a half-breed, you're demon-possessed, that's how you're doing these things. And then in Matthew 12, starting in verse 23, says, all the crowds were amazed and were saying, this man cannot be the son of David, can he? Son of David being a messianic title. And they're expecting a Messiah that works miracles. And so they're saying, hey, you know, is this the guy? Verse 24 of Matthew 12. But when the Pharisees heard this, they said, this man casts out demons only by Beelzebub, the ruler of demons. So Jesus, yes, he's doing miracles, but it's from Satan. You know, he's demon-possessed, he's a Samaritan. And Jesus kind of explodes that argument going on through verse 28. But they didn't deny the miracles, though. And then finally, point number six John has here. Those who recorded the miracles as eyewitnesses, the gospel writers except Luke, have every appearance of being credible. So we have very ancient, very well-attested, factually accurate, historically reliable documents that make up our New Testament. You know, they're all part of the first century, and they're accurate as far as we can fact-check them. And they contain these accounts, some from eyewitnesses. And Richard Baucom, a New Testament scholar, has a whole book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. And he makes the case for there is eyewitness testimony in the Gospels, and there are signs of it that you can find. And it's an interesting scholarly book if you're interested in that. But Richard Baucom, he's a, let me see, it's a B-A-U-C-K-H-A-M, I think. But Jesus and the Eyewitnesses is the title for the book. I know you guys have already looked at this in previous weeks, the Testimonium Flavianum from Josephus. So Josephus is basically a Jewish Roman historian that researches all this. He was born in the 30s, so a few years after Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, and grows up in the area of Jerusalem and Judea. He's one of the elite there. He becomes a Pharisee. So he knows this area. He knows these people. He does the research. He basically becomes part of the Flavian family, the emperor's family, more or less, because he's called Flavius Josephus. And so Josephus would have access to the imperial archives of the Romans and had a lot of sources. And so at the end of the first century, like around 90 or 95, he's putting together this history of the Jewish people. And he has this passage I know that you've looked at in previous weeks, but I'm highlighting that it talks about Jesus here. He was one who wrought surprising feats. He was a doer of wonderful works. And this phrase in the Greek that Josephus is using is the same phrase Josephus uses to describe Elijah and Elisha's ministries, which those were some of the biggest miracle-working prophets of the Old Testament. So Josephus, not a Christian, he's like, yeah, this Jesus of Nazareth was a doer of wonderful works. He's reporting that as history at the end of the first century. Celsus, this is a critic of Christianity. He's writing an attack on Christianity. He's a Neoplatonist philosopher. And his theory is what he claims is Jesus of Nazareth, quote, having hired himself out as a servant in Egypt on account of his poverty, and having there acquired some miraculous powers, on which the Egyptians greatly pride themselves, returned to his own country, highly elated on account of them, and by means of these proclaimed himself to be a god. So this is not a historian. This is not a guy doing history. This is a Neoplatonic philosopher attacking Christianity. This is a polemic, just trying to tear down Christianity. But notice he doesn't say that Jesus was a phony, he was a charlatan. He says, he had powers, but he was an Egyptian sorcerer. You know how those Egyptians guys are. Those guys are nuts. So, you know, he went there and learned a bunch of this, you know, the Chinese linking rings and the ball in the cup trick. And, you know, he's learned some tricks and developed. But he doesn't deny there were miracles. He just gives a different interpretation of what they are. Different explanation. And I know you've looked at this as well in the Babylonian Talmud. The Talmud is basically a Jewish writing, and this is a collection of 1,000 years of stories and sayings of the rabbi, of the rabbis. The Talmud was trying to preserve this oral tradition of, you know, this rabbi argued this rabbi argued that, and they want to preserve that, particularly after the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. they want to preserve their Jewish tradition that is being destroyed. And they kind of compile all this, and it takes centuries to do. So the Talmud, this is not ancient historians. These are rabbis. They're not writing history. They're just trying to do a collection of rabbinic teachings and sayings. And so if this was all we had on the historical Jesus, granted, it wouldn't be much. But it is a mention here, and even if it's a non-historical one. But they said Jesus was executed for practicing sorcery.
Wow.
For practicing witchcraft. So the Babylonian Talmud basically agrees with what the New Testament says. The Pharisees and the scribes, the Sadducees were saying about Jesus, that he was demon-possessed, he's casting out demons by Beelzebub, by Satan, the king of the demons. And so here they're saying he was practicing sorcery, he was practicing witchcraft, and leading Israel astray. He was a false prophet, he was doing, you know, lying miracles. But notice they don't deny he's doing miracles. They admit, yes, but they give a different interpretation of it. And this wouldn't be, like I said, wouldn't be a great source in and of itself, but it does agree with the first century sources we have in the New Testament of the criticisms that he got from the Jews. So in other words, it's like this. I hear he turned water into wine, but it was a rather poor quality Mesopotamian Cabernet. So, yeah, he did miracles, but I don't know. So, no one denies that Jesus is a miracle worker. None of the contemporary sources that we have, obviously in the New Testament, the early Christian writings, but these are non-Christian writings. And all the sources we have confirm, yes, he was a miracle worker. The difference is, the New Testament is saying this proves that Jesus is the Messiah. He is God the Son come into the world. He has a message of salvation for us. The other sources are saying different things. That, oh, well, yeah, he was a great miracle worker. Or, yes, he did these things, but he was, you know, in league with the devil. But no one denies the miracles. Now, so what do modern scholars do with this, of the historical Jesus? What do they do with the evidence? Well, here is N.T. Wright. He's a New Testament scholar, theologically conservative, maybe not as much as we would be. But N.T. Wright is, at the time I first started really presenting on this, he was the Bishop of Durham in the Anglican Church in England, prominent New Testament scholar. He's left that post in the Anglican Church, and he's now at University of St. Andrews, I think, teaching once again. But a New Testament scholar, one of the top experts on the historical Jesus, he wrote a book, it's hundreds of pages on the resurrection of Jesus. And so it's probably the strongest scholarly case for Jesus rising from the dead. But it's about that thick, so I haven't launched into that one yet, but John will get into a much shorter, more accessible case for the resurrection next week, I think, and John will have to pick up the pieces from everything I didn't get to today. But this is N.T. Wright, and he writes in this book, this is one of his shorter books, he cranks out quite a few books. A very prolific author, best-selling author. This is one of his shorter books, The Challenge of Jesus. He says on page 39 about Jesus, he says, quote, "He acted practically and symbolically, not least through his remarkable works of healing, works that today all but the most extreme skeptics are forced to regard as in principle historical," end quote. And this is one of the... Some regard him to be the leading New Testament scholar in the world and an expert on the historical Jesus. N.T. Wright, he did a book with another best-selling author, Marcus Borg. Marcus Borg is part of the Jesus Seminar, and if you've heard of them, that's a very radically skeptical group of New Testament scholars, very skeptical. And so Marcus Borg is a more theologically liberal than N.T. Wright. And so they did this book together. They're actually colleagues and friends. And they did this book together. called The Meaning of Jesus, Two Visions. And it's an interesting book because N.T. Wright is a scholar of the historical Jesus, scholar of the New Testament. He presents a more theologically conservative view of a topic about Jesus. And then Marcus Borg will, write his chapter, presenting a more liberal Protestant kind of view, a little more skeptical. And so they kind of go back and forth through the entire book, alternating chapters of, oh, here's my take on the resurrection. Oh, well, here's my take on it. Well, did Jesus work miracles? And they kind of go back and forth. And it's a good book to get to compare and contrast the views. But Marcus Borg, in this book, The Meaning of Jesus, Two Visions, page 66, he says, quote, in common with the majority of contemporary Jesus scholars, let me highlight that. In common with the majority of contemporary Jesus scholars, I see the claim that Jesus performed paranormal healings and exorcisms as history remembered. Indeed, more healing stories are told about Jesus than any other figure in the Jewish tradition. He must have been a remarkable healer. End quote. But you could say, well, look, liberal, conservative, wherever they're coming from, Jesus Seminar, Marcus Borg and N.T. Wright both regard themselves as Christians. Marcus Borg actually just died in January, just a few months ago. But these two men, they're on different ends of the spectrum, but it's a Christian spectrum. These both guys claim to be Christians. So, yeah, they're going to say, Jesus is a good guy. Yeah, Jesus is awesome. They're part of the Jesus fan club. So, of course, what do you expect him to say? Then we have Geza Vermesh. Geza Vermesh is a Jew. He's a Hungarian Jew. He's part of the liberal Jewish synagogue in London. He actually died in 2013, so just a few years ago. He was Professor Emeritus of Jewish Studies and Emeritus Fellow of Wolfson College, Oxford, and continued to teach until his death in 2013 at the Oriental Institute at Oxford. And John Crace of The Guardian, that's a newspaper in England, back in 2008, an article on Geza Vermesh said, described him as, quote, the man often described as the greatest Jesus scholar of his generation. So Geza Vermesh is not a Christian, has rejected Christianity in his personal life. There's a whole story there. But very respected scholar. He wrote this book, The Complete Dead Sea Scrolls, in English. He was one of the first translators of the Dead Sea Scrolls, one of the top experts in the world on the Dead Sea Scrolls. He's an expert on the Aramaic language. So he was one person that could sit in the audience. If you remember The Passion of the Christ, that Mel Gibson film, it's all in Aramaic with some Latin, and then they have English subtitles, Geza Vermesh and Peter J. Williams, he's one of the scholars that could sit in the audience and A Passion of the Christ and is like, oh, okay. He doesn't need the subtitles. Could just listen. Why do they have kind of an Arabic accent to the Aramaic here? That's weird. Why are they doing that? So that was a different movie-going experience for him than it would be for most of us. But And an expert on the historical Jesus, written a number of books on Jesus. This was, I believe, a 2002 book, The Changing Faces of Jesus. Page 249 of the book, Geza Vermesh says that the historical Jesus, the, quote, real Jesus, unquote, was, quote, a prophet-like holy man, mighty in deed and word, a charismatic healer, an exorcist, end quote. So this man is not a Christian. He's rejected Christianity. Here's a Jewish scholar, one of the top historical Jesus scholars, and he says, yeah, everybody says he did miracles. All the contemporary sources agree he did miracles. Obviously, he did miracles. So it's really startling, and we'll just close with this. Why, John Oakes asked, why did Jesus do miracles? Because he had compassion. Because, Jesus genuinely cared for people. He was moved. To fulfill prophecy, as we talked about believe in that same Matthew 12 passage, the disciples of John the Baptist come to Jesus and they say, are you the expected one? In other words, are you the Messiah? Are you the one who is to come? And Jesus said, go tell John the Baptist what you've seen and heard. You know, the deaf are hearing, the blind receive their sight. So these are the miracles Jesus was doing, but he was doing them in fulfillment of prophecy. That's straight out of Isaiah 35, as well as other passages in the Old Testament. And you remember the Messiah apocalypse and the Dead Sea Scrolls. There was this expectation, and Jesus said, I am fulfilling these messianic expectations right before your eyes. So he did have compassion. He is trying to meet the immediate needs, but he's got a bigger purpose. This is testifying about who he is. To validate his message, which is one of the purposes of a miracle. He's doing it because of people's faith. You know, people came to Jesus believing that he was a man of God, that he was Messiah, and that brought healing. And, you know, your faith has made you well. That's something Jesus says to a lot of people that he healed. To create faith in people. Jesus even talks about that in this passage in John about, you know, if you can't at least believe on the basis of the miracles themselves, doesn't this, you know, communicate something? And, of course, the last and maybe a very important reason, because his mom asked him to. At least on one occasion.
Yeah.
Honey, you know, the wedding's going to be ruined. You got to do something. And then, you know, a good Jewish mother, you know, has little high expectations for her son and, you know, gets in there with it. Hey, you guys do whatever he tells you to do. And, you know, then Jesus does the whole thing. And this really go that last water into wine miracle. A Christian apologist, Dr. Norman Geisler, a Christian philosopher, his little quip in talks and debates and different things that he's done, he said, what's so hard about water into wine? I mean, that's how it always happens. The water comes down in the rain. It goes down into the earth. It brings up moisture and nutrients into the roots, and it goes into the grapevine, and the grapes are there, and they stop the grapes, and it ferments, and you get wine. Jesus just eliminated all those middle steps. He just skipped straight, you know, from water to the wine. There was a Christian apologist philosopher died a few years ago at USC, Dr. Dallas Willard. And he said he was sharing with a chemistry professor, and the chemistry professor was well, we know E equals MC squared, that matter can go into energy, energy can go into matter. We know the ratios and how that would work. We know the chemical and physical properties of matter and the laws of physics and chemistry. If Jesus was to transmute H2O into wine, that would liberate so much chemical energy, it would have melted those pots. And Dallas Willard said, well, maybe we should call it the miracle of the preserved pots. You know, Jesus is the master of molecules. If he can, you know, turn the water into wine, he can probably handle all that excess energy and everything released. But that comes back to kind of where we began and maybe where it all began, Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning, the Word was with God and the Word was God. You know, the God of the Bible created everything. He sustains everything. And so he is capable of doing all these different miracles that are recorded in Scripture. And the miracles have a message. And they're telling us about Jesus. And you look at the quality and the quantity of miracles that Jesus did. And Jesus stands out among all the figures in world history, all the so-called miracle workers. And it made such an impression on his day that everyone had to concede that that was the case, even Jesus' enemies. You know, Jew, Christian, Gentile, you know, friend or foe, everybody agreed, yes, Jesus of Nazareth works miracles. But then they had to put maybe a different spins on it, but that was a fact no one could deny. And such an undeniable fact that historical Jesus scholars today, the experts on Jesus of Nazareth and the history in his times, they concede that Jesus did miracles. They say, well, you know, all our sources say that he did, so obviously there was something going on. So then they have their little spins and their little interpretations on, you know, what was going on. But it's an interpretation of a fact. They can't really deny it. And that's what I found. Were you guys aware of this is what Jesus scholars are saying today? That this is what Jesus scholars are saying today, that yes, he worked miracles. I was really astonished the more I dug into this, the more that these top scholars from all different backgrounds, Jew, Christian, atheist, whatever their perspective, they're like, well, yeah, that's kind of what it all says there. So you can't really deny it. And so that really testifies that Jesus is Lord, he is Messiah, he is who he claimed to be. And John will share more about that, the incarnation and the resurrection, some of the crowning miracles of Jesus next week. But thanks a lot. Thanks for putting up with me.